Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Back in 1969, anyone older than 10 or 12 knew Charles Manson. In a bizarre rampage that year, Manson was connected to murders of 9 people, including the actress Sharon Tate. That a cult was involved sent the story into orbit, and once details of the spectacularly brutal murders leaked to the press, only pushed the story more. Now a new book examines Charles Manson's upbringing and what brought him to such a deprived place. We'll talk about it this morning. Later on this hour, a new children's book looks at immigration through a child's eyes. But first up, author Jeff Gwynne's new book, Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. Jeff Gwynne has been on this show twice before for The Last Gunfight, the real story of the shootout at the OK Corral and how it changed the American West, and Go Down Together, the true untold story of Bonnie and Clyde. And Jeff, welcome back. Really good to have you back in town again.
Well, thank you very much. I always try to have Kansas City be the last stop on my book tours because then I get to see you.
Oh, that's great.
And then I get to do a wonderful program at night with Rainy Day Books. So nothing beats Kansas City.
Good place to wrap up, that's for sure. Well, Jeff, let's get into the details of what happened during the summer of 69. We'll get into those later on. But remind us, just how big a story did Charles Manson become back then, and how much terror did he strike into the hearts of Americans from California to Topeka all the way out to Charlotte?
The thing about Manson in 1970, 69, the murders occur in August. Manson is arrested and arraigned late in the year. But the real horror of what happened only sort of breaks in early 1970. And you've got to remember what America's been through at this particular time.
Right.
We've had horrible political assassinations, divisiveness over the war is splitting the country, there's race riots in just about every major American city, and yet this creepy little man begins to dominate news coverage in a way that I don't think anyone since Bruno Hauptmann in the Lindbergh kidnapping had captured America's horror-stricken imagination.
And he did so. Why? What was it about Charles Manson, the diminutive Charles Manson, as you put it, that so captured people?
He's an actor. He knows how to play to the public. And that was the scariest thing about him I've found in these 3 years. He's not crazy now. He never has been insane. He is cold. He is calculating. And it has all been an act that he has successfully perpetrated on the public for 44 years.
How do you know it's been an act?
Because I have followed him now every step of the way. We've always accepted his version of his childhood, that he was the illegitimate son of a teenage prostitute.
That's right. I remember all that.
Tried to sell him for a pitcher of beer, and by the time he was 9 or 10, wanted nothing to do with him and threw him into the juvenile justice system. Poor, poor Charlie.
Pretty good story.
Great story, and that's exactly what it is, fiction. And so I've been able to find relatives, blood relatives of his sister, his cousin. Actually, his sister was adopted, but you know what I mean when I say Manson family as opposed to the Manson capital F family.
Yeah.
People he grew up with, people he served time with in prison. I've talked to old girlfriends from his high school years. It just – and when you track him, the truth is there. It's hard to find, but once you start putting the pieces together, what emerges – is the Charles Manson, who becomes so infamous in 1969 and 1970, has been doing these things from the time he was in the first grade.
The pattern you point out was set early on with this guy.
In first grade. I first had this story from his cousin Joanne, and it was later corroborated by several people, old folks now, still living in McMeekin, West Virginia, who were there. First grade, Charlie organizes some of the girls in his class to beat up a boy he doesn't like. The principal comes to get Charlie, and he tells her, "It's not my fault. The girls were doing what they wanted to do. You can't blame me." Same defense all those years later he uses in Tate LaBianca.
Same thing. Same story. I didn't do it. They did it.
Right.
I didn't have any control over that.
Yeah. How can I be blamed for something other people do?
Well, did Charles Manson speak to you for this book, and did you try?
For about 5 months, I sent him a letter a day. "Talk to me, please." And heard nothing. Then he wrote me a letter.
It was not
a friendly letter about how people like me always want him to help out on the come. "I'll do something for you if you do something for me." But I wasn't going to do anything for him. And then he added a cryptic P.S. "They don't let me interview as I want." And that's when I found out he'd had most of his visitation privileges revoked. because in his high-security prison, he'd been caught with a couple cell phones that his current followers had smuggled in. And his followers claim that this was planted by the government, but according to the prison authorities, he fashioned a shank out of a toothbrush handle. He's 78 years old. He's still doing this stuff. But he very kindly passed along my contact information to some of his current followers who have been in touch with me, email and mail, suggesting that I had better write a book he approves of or else.
How did you feel about that?
Yeah, you know this, Steve. You've been a public figure for a long time.
Yeah.
The ones who threaten you, you never have to worry about.
Yeah. Well, he looked like the devil. Absolutely. Describe the type of power he had over the people around him, Jeff, because it's just a remarkable part of this story.
Well, the power that he had was not any sort of mystic ability. What Charles Manson did, and he did this brilliantly, was he cobbled together a sort of hypnotic come on to people that comes in equal parts from Bible studies. His grandmother was fundamentalist and made him go to church with her. Song lyrics. Lines that he cribbed from the other street gurus in Haight-Ashbury. I've got witnesses talking about how Manson would study the other gurus, then come to the free clinic in San Francisco, practice the lines on the sick hippies there, and when he thought he had them down, he would go out and he would present this as his own. But his main focus, main font of information to draw people in.
I know where you're going.
Yeah, and it's amazing. Mm-hmm. He's in prison, and
Before the murders.
Mm-hmm. He's in prison. Charlie was imprisoned at various times for sex trafficking, bringing women over state lines for moral purposes, car theft, armed robbery, and even once forging a government check that he then tried to eat so they wouldn't have the evidence. He was a career small criminal. But he's in prison, and the prison offers some courses to help inmates acquire skills to help in the outside world.
Yeah.
He takes a Dale Carnegie course.
How to win friends and influence people.
And right there, he knew he had something special. And I've talked to cellmates at the time. He'd come back to the cell from class practicing the lines. And later in California Institution for Women's Prison with Patricia Krenwinkel and Leslie Van Houten.
Two of his family members.
Right,
two
of the convicted Tate LaBianca killers. And I said to them, what could Charlie Manson possibly have said to you when you first met him that made you fascinated by him and feel that he really understood you? And they said, well, Charlie said this and this and this. Word for word, chapter 7, How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Like, for example, what, Jeff? What are you talking about?
If you read chapter 7 has a list of ways to make people trust you. And, of course, Carnegie intended this for good. Let me make that clear. He never intended, you know, somebody like Charles Manson to misuse it. Let the other fellow feel that the idea is his own. The only way to interest someone is to find out what their goals are and make them feel you can help them attain them. Dramatize everything. Actors do it. Movies do it. And you must do it to draw attention to your ideas. Everything that Charlie Manson went out later and did was based on a foundation of Dale Carnegie principles.
Huh. So what made you want to dive back into this story, Jeff? What was it about Charles Manson so many years ago that sort of hung with you a little bit here?
Well, what I always want to do with my books is pick an era in American history and try to recapture it for the reader. And, of course, the late 1960s, you're much too young to remember, but
No, I
was there. And it was a chaotic, amazing time in American history, and mm-hmm. I wanted to write about that. And events don't happen in a vacuum. History doesn't happen out of nowhere. If Charles Manson had been in any other place, any other time, none of this works. So what I wanted to do was first write a book that would demystify Charles Manson, show us really who he is as opposed to this caricature. Second thing, show how things happening in America came together in this one place and time, and he took horrific advantage of them.
Yeah.
Because if we can understand that, Charlie Manson is with us in our culture forever. We're stuck with him. But at least if we can know him for who and what he is, we can have him in proper perspective.
Jeff Gwynn is our guest. Yeah, he's the author of the new book, Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. You know, there was a sense back in those days that the killings that Manson's family was involved in were all about, you know, this sort of the end of the 1960s and the culmination of, at least in some people's eyes, all that had gone wrong in America, that what it would all added up to was something and somebody like a Charles Manson doing what Charles Manson did.
In fact, Richard Nixon made some political hay about that during the Manson trial and almost had a mistrial declared because of it. Vincent Bugliosi, who's been wonderfully generous to me.
Who wrote Helter Skelter, the big bestseller off this murder. Yeah.
As I was working on this book, Vincent Bugliosi could not have been kinder, getting me in touch with people, offering me his opinions about things, which have changed some over the years. And the thing about Manson, it was a time in America where we were able to believe, even eager to believe, any extreme. So many amazing things were happening, good and bad. Man walked on the moon. The Mets won the World Series. These would have been two things that we never would have expected to happen even 10 years earlier. Manson caught the attention of the public because this was a story so horrifying and so different. There had been mass murders before, certainly, and there have been since. But some sort of guru, some evil long-haired guru, getting his insane followers together and sending them out to commit murder. And it caught the public's attention. And because Manson knew how to play it, and he truly did, he's a performer. Give him credit. He did not have the musical talent to ever be a rock superstar, even though he thought he did. But by golly, he understood the way people think and the ways they can be scared and impressed. He's taken full advantage of it for 44 years.
You know, what makes you think, Jeff, when you start off on these projects, like you did Bonnie and Clyde, you did the shootout at the OK Corral, you take these subjects that have been well documented, written about so often, you know, over the course of the decades, what makes you think there's more to the story to tell when you take on a topic like this?
History, for a lot of people, is what's most convenient for them to believe. And whether it's Bonnie and Clyde, whether it's a shootout at the OK Corral, which wasn't a shootout and wasn't at the OK Corral, or it's...
But never mind.
Right.
Yeah.
Or it's Charles Manson, we buy into mythology. And I've always believed that the facts, the truth, is even more fascinating. Mm-hmm. And there are certainly people who are better writers than me. But the way I always approach it is I get in my car and I just go everywhere these people have been. And you talk to people, and you talk to people, and then you find someone who's got a story to tell that can be corroborated who hasn't been talked to before.
Yeah.
And then that person suggests another person. The pieces come together. A lot of it's dumb luck.
Mm-hmm.
But I have never written a book that has more new, surprising information in it than this book about Charles Manson.
Well, you mentioned, Jeff, you found a couple of close relatives who had never spoken to any reporter before about this story. Who were they? Because that really surprised me, again, given the amount of attention that Charles Manson has received over the years.
Manson's sister Nancy and his cousin Joanne have spent all these years trying not to be found.
Mm-hmm.
When I first heard word that there might be a cousin, there might be a sister, and I heard these things in McMicken, West Virginia, and I looked, and it was hard. Manson's mother was so determined that her daughter would never be linked to Charles that she even had the wrong dates of her birth and death put on her tombstone. So that if anybody tracked her down that far, they would say, well, this couldn't be Kathleen Maddox.
Wow.
Because the dates don't match up. That's how far she took it. When I found out where they were, and it was hard, I didn't just want to knock on their doors and say, hi, you've been dreading this for 44 years.
Here I am.
Tell me everything.
Here's your worst nightmare. Yeah.
So I sent them registered letters. Hi, this is who I am. This is the kind of book I'd like to write. May I send you copies of some of my earlier books so you can see the kind of writer I am?
Smart approach. Yeah.
I told them right away, if you don't want to cooperate with me, I will not give your information to anybody else. You don't need to worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
They each corresponded with me first through email, then we talked on the phone. They live far, far away from each other, and neither knew the other one existed, by the way. And finally, they each said, well, you can come out and we'll see about it. And so I would fly out. I met with them. And gradually they decided they wanted to tell the truth. The lies he's been telling for years are offensive to them. In fact, I had a two-day break in this book tour 9 days ago. And I used the break to fly out to see Nancy, Manson's sister, and give her a book and give her back her original photos, some of which are in the book. The photos, I think, would astonish most people.
I so understand. I mean, it just is really interesting to me that you found these people. They had something to say. Because at some point in your email box or in your mailbox, you have a letter show up from Charles Manson.
That's true.
Or Charles Manson's sister. That must have been just an amazing moment for you, given the amount of time you put into this thing.
Well, the mailman's very nervous right now coming to my house. I get letters from Patricia Krenwinkle and Leslie Van Houten and people like that now. A lot of luck was involved in this. It isn't any kind of book undertaking when you're trying to get past the mythology. But that's the fun of it. It's hard, but it's interesting, if that makes sense. Yeah. And at the end, hopefully you have a book that readers will enjoy reading. It should be a good story. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, they learn a lot they didn't know before, and they get the context of the time and the event.
Jeff Wynn is our guest. His book, Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson, he'll be speaking tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Country Club Plaza. Call Rainy Day Books and Fairway for more information. That number, as always, 913-384-3126. That's tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Again, call Rainy Day Books, 913-384-3126. Let's move ahead in this story just a little bit here. You begin the book by talking about Charles, the Beach Boy, Dennis Wilson,
right,
and his connection with Dennis Wilson. There's always been all this mythology about what that was all about. What was his connection to the Beach Boys and Dennis Wilson?
Manson expected he would become a rock and roll star. And at that time, to do that, you had to come to Los Angeles. His idea was not, well, I'm going to go audition for a lot of producers and somebody will notice my talent and sign me. Charlie wanted to glom on to some rock star, figuring if the star said sign Charlie Manson, his label would. So he would send the women in the family out trolling for rock stars. And Patricia Krenwinkle, and this is the first time she's ever talked fully on the record about all this, said she and another woman family member are hitchhiking in Los Angeles. And this guy pulls up in a Mercedes convertible and says, hey, you want to come to my house for milk and cookies? And they went to his house and were astonished.
Why not? Sure. Of course.
They were astonished. He meant it. He gave them milk and cookies and said, you know, I've got to go to a recording session, but I've enjoyed talking to you too. I hope you come back sometime. And they went back and Manson said, well, who was this guy? And we didn't know who he was, but he says in some band called the Beach Boys.
Oh, my gosh.
Dennis Wilson gets back from that recording session, and Manson and the family are inside his house having a party. Manson glommed on to Dennis Wilson trying to get a recording contract. When that didn't work, he decided he'd go higher up the food chain in the music business, and one of Wilson's best friends was Terry Melcher, the Boy Wonder producer at the time, the Byrds, Paul Revere and the Raiders. He was turning out hit after hit for Columbia. Manson knew that if only Melcher could hear him audition, he'd sign him up. When Melcher didn't, and Manson had failed so publicly in front of his followers, that was one of the keys to the horrible things that were going to happen just a few weeks later.
In what way? Explain that to me.
Gurus have to always succeed to keep their followers. And Manson has had a core group of about 24 people now with him for a year and a half, promising them all these wonderful things that are going to happen in the rock star end of it. So that's not going to happen. He's failed. So he has to turn his attention to other things he's been telling them will come. And he's been saying there's going to be a race war, helter skelter. The blacks are going to rise up against the whites.
Right.
And while this war goes on, the Manson family will hide out in the Mojave Desert. The blacks will win the war. But Manson had no appreciation of African Americans as anything above subhumans. And he told his followers they wouldn't know how to run the world. So the Manson family would come out of the desert and they would rule the world.
My gosh.
I know. But this tells you how I had these people indoctrinated. At the same time, a drug deal's gone bad And Manson has directed the murder of a guy named Gary Hinman, a music teacher who sometimes dealt drugs. Manson's friend Bobby Beausoleil has been arrested for the crime, and Manson's worried that Beausoleil is going to turn on him and get the police on Charlie. So he needs copycat murders. They tried to make the Hinman murder look like black militants had done it. So the next step for Charlie is two things. First of all, get your followers to kill somebody rich and famous and make it look like it was black militants. That gets Beausoleil sprung. The other half of it is Manson, I think, knew very well. Vince Bugliosi and I have discussed this at length. Manson really didn't think Helter Skelter, an apocalyptic race war, was coming. But if through these murders there might be a new race riot in Los Angeles, that's something he can point to his followers and say, see, I told you it was going to happen.
Huh.
So all these threads come together.
But the notion that somebody would glom onto that kind of thinking and want to associate themselves with someone who's talking and thinking like Charles Manson, that's a little hard for me to reach.
But you've got to remember, you and I, and I'm sure every member of your audience, if we'd been back there then, we would have had sufficient self-esteem and common sense to say no. Manson starts his recruiting in Haight-Ashbury in the Summer of Love when you get all these lost, all these lost teenagers who are wandering there looking for someone to tell them what to do. Manson charms them initially. He keeps them doped up. He's careful to isolate them, Spahn Ranch, the Mojave Desert.
Wow.
So he's the only influence on them. And at a certain point, as some of the family members have told me, you basically decide you've either got to stick with Charlie or go out there in that big, terrible world where you've already proven you can't function.
Jeff Gwynn is our guest. His book, again, Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. You know, so take us up to the Tate-LaBianca murders, and you sort of set the table for this. How does Charles Manson arrange to have all this actually take place?
Manson goes straight back to Dale Carnegie, let the other fellow think the idea is his own. He picks Tex Watson because Charlie is very much a misogynist. If there's going to be a leader for murders, it ain't going to be a woman because women have to be subservient. And basically makes Watson think it's Watson's idea to go to Cielo Drive. They knew Terry Melcher didn't live there anymore, but they also felt that you really would have to be rich and famous to be able to afford that place. So whoever is in there, if you kill them and make it look like black militants, the media is going to have to pay attention.
Right.
The women who went along that night, three of them, Susan Atkins, Linda Kasabian, Patricia Krenwinkel, did not know they were going out there to kill people. They thought on the whole ride over that they were just going to try to commit a robbery. They only found out after they got there and had climbed the fence when Watson told them they were going to kill everyone there. And Krenwinkel walked me through step by step both nights of murder. She said she would be honest, and she was. I give her credit for that, but it's horrifying stuff.
Was it hard for her to walk you through that after all these years? I mean, is she a changed human being from those days?
I will say this after spending many, many hours with her.
In prison.
And with Leslie Van Houten. I believe they are genuinely remorseful. Both of them are trying to do things that are helpful. Leslie just finished her master's in philosophy.
Oh, my gosh.
And sets up educational program for young women in the prison. Patricia Krenwinkel trains rescue dogs to be guide dogs for the blind. And when Patricia was telling me these stories, she hasn't talked about this to anybody for 44 years. She's crying and shaking. Hmm. And she said at one point, I shouldn't have done it. It was absolutely wrong. But I was afraid for myself, and that's why I did it.
Afraid for myself in the sense that if I don't go through with this, Charlie won't be
Manson
happy.
Manson was physically violent against the women quite often. He would give them beatings. He would make them stand against trees and throw knives into the trees over their head like a carnival act, telling them if they flinched, that proved they didn't trust him. Like any pimp, and in a sense he was.
Mm-hmm.
He kept women by preying on their insecurities and also by physically scaring them.
That's how he operated.
He is an awful man, but he is not insane. He was never crazy. It was all cold and calculating. he's frightening because of that.
Why do you think Leslie and Patricia decided to sit down with you, Jeff, after all these years? I mean, was there just a sense that you were able to convince them that, hey, you've never really told this story, the time has come before it's too late, and it was horrific, but, you know, it's time to tell the story?
Well, I talked to Leslie first. I knew Patricia had never talked to anyone and it would be harder. And my advantage with Leslie is I was able to tell her all about Manson's background, and she'd never known that. The first time I met her and we talked, she said, "You're really making me suffer here," because I had worked out in my mind that he was this big evil genius, and I had no choice but to be dominated by him, and now you're telling me he's really just another abusive man. After my third visit to see Leslie, I said, "I want you to be aware I'm going to try to talk to Patricia Krenwinkel." They're in the same facility, but they're not close at all anymore.
I'm sorry, in California?
Yes, California Institution for Women in Corona.
Mm-hmm.
And Leslie said, "Well, it's okay. I've already talked to Pat. She's going to talk to you. She's filled out the visitor form, and you can come back and see her."
How often were you able to go visit with them?
I saw Leslie 3 times, and I would see her on Saturday and Sunday, 3 and 4 hour chunks each. And then I saw Patricia Krenwinkel 2 times, same sort of arrangement.
And are you speaking through them through glass, or how does it work?
You have guards, but you can sit across a table from each other.
Could you record their voices?
No, you're not allowed to bring in recording devices or pencil and paper. So I'd have to go back to my motel after they would tell me these horrifying things, type it into my laptop, and then try to go to sleep, and it was hard.
Man. The key here is that Charles Manson himself wasn't involved with the murders per se. Explain how all that worked.
Under California law, someone who plans a murder and helps put it together is just as guilty of the murder as the people who do the actual killing.
Right.
And though Manson always claims he never killed anybody, that's not true. Some weeks after the Tate LaBianca murders, he was one of several people who murdered Shorty Shea, a Spahn ranch hand. Manson's defense has always been, they were doing what they wanted, it wasn't me. And in fact, he was a master manipulator, and he used his various techniques to make these people carry out what he wanted. But he was fully behind it. The second night, he actually took them out to the house where the LaBiancas were murdered.
Really? Well, Jeff, you've done Bonnie and Clyde, you've done the O.K. Corral, you've done Charles Manson. What's next?
Well, I was thinking of writing another book about Santa Claus.
That was your first big hit, right?
Yeah,
I forgot about that. That's right.
What I always want to continue doing is writing about eras in American history and the real story rather than the mythology.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm going to go into the 1970s next. And there's a fascinating character who in the 1950s and 60s was one of the civil rights leaders in America, ranked right up there with Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks. When he spoke to the California State Legislature, he was introduced as America's Gandhi. Hmm. And his name is Jim Jones.
I remember it well. Those massacre in
Guyana. Jonestown,
that's right. That's right, yeah. Well, always good to have you here, Jeff. Congratulations on the latest book, and good luck in the future, okay?
Thank you very much, and congratulations to you on your new teaching position.
Well,
your
thank
students
you.
Are very lucky.
Day one was today. It went pretty well.
Good.
Thanks for
you.
Saying the nice words. Again, that's Jeff Gwynn, his new book, Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. He speaks tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Call Renaday Books in Fairway for more information, 913-384-3126.